Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
All right, from The Verge, sciency salmon is on the way. We now have our first ever approval from the FDA on a safety consultation for lab-grown fish. Mm. And this makes Wildtype only the fourth company to get approval from the regulator to sell cell-cultivated animal products. So the cultivated salmon is now available to order from one Portland restaurant.
I was going to say, do we have it here in Austin? Because it sounds like the kind of thing we would have in Austin, but I guess not yet.
You know, Austin and the landlocked cities would probably be one of the better candidates for this. I mean, depending on how it's actually made. But if you just need like a lab to get fresher fish than something that has to get frozen and shipped, I mean.
Well, and we're all into the ecology of let's not slaughter animals. Let's grow some meat. Like Austin's going to be on the hippie vanguard of that, I'm sure.
Aw, that's so optimistic of you.
We are in Texas. I do have to acknowledge that. Yeah.
Like, we just legalized shooting bighorn sheep from helicopters now. So, you know.
Oh, wow.
We did.
Oh, gosh. Are you excited about that?
No, I'm just, I'm shocked that I haven't heard about it. I'm not. Okay. Anyway.
Anyway, basically, the FDA sent a letter that declared that it had, quote, no questions about whether the cultivated salmon is, quote, as safe as comparable foods, which honestly may say more about the FDA right now than anything else. But still, the customary final step in the FDA's approval process for lab-grown animal products is this no questions declaration. So here's a fun fact. The FDA has responsibility for regulating most lab-grown seafood, but the task is shared with the USDA for cultivated meat.
Oh, they hate each other. They fight all the time.
I imagine
it's
they
like
must.
It's like firefighters and cops, right?
Yeah.
Now, the FDA pre-market safety consultation is voluntary. There are other pathways that include like self-affirmation of safety, as well as a longer food additive review process.
Wait. Back up. Self-affirmation of safety?
Yeah, you heard that exactly right. If you're wondering how we became a country of grifters, self-affirmation of safety as a legal regulatory process might require a second look, right?
I just figured that was the salmon looking in the mirror going, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough.
I'm good enough, gosh darn it, people like me.
Exactly right. So kudos to Wildtype for not catering to that particular path and actually asking the FDA to weigh in here. But yeah, this authorization with a no questions letter, it's considered sort of a middle ground. So, you know, if you can't aim high, aim middle.
Yeah.
Now, Wildtype salmon is now on the menu at a Haitian restaurant called Kann. That's K-A-N-N. And the company has opened up a wait list for the next 5 restaurants to stock the fish. Mm. It is joining companies Upside Foods and Good Meat. These are 2 companies with permission to sell cultivated chicken in the U.S., while Mission Barns has been cleared by the FDA but is waiting USDA approval for its cultivated pork fat. Mm-mm-mm. Now, at the state level, well, the situation's a little more complicated because 8 states are issuing bans on lab-grown meat as the tech becomes a conservative talking point.
I mean, it is genetically meat, right? Like, I mean, I know it's lab-grown, but it's not like a Beyond Burger where it's not really meat. It's just we cultured these cells as opposed to killing an animal for them.
Yeah, it's like instead of cancer being something that kills the body, that mechanism is now a food-producing kind of thing.
I imagine the states that are against it are all ranching states, too.
Mm, that's true.
Yeah. Well, somebody think of the slaughterers. All right, next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from Nautilus. Clergy blown away by psilocybin.
Ooh!
Almost a decade ago, a Baptist biblical scholar, a Catholic priest, several rabbis, an Islamic leader, a Zen Buddhist Roshi, and more than a dozen other religious leaders walked into a lab. Yeah. But the punchline is, and took high doses of magic mushrooms.
Mm-hmm. High doses. That's interesting because usually this kind of thing is like, oh, you're microdosing and you have your therapist. So they went all out. Okay.
Mm. Well, but the macrodosing is how you get the religious experience. Mm. So to do this for the religious profession, I'm really eager to hear how this turned out.
So all of them lied and said it was the first time taking the drug. The mind-altering detail of these guided trips were recorded at the time, but it wasn't until recently that the results of the controversial experiment came to light. So one might wonder how a single trip could compare to a catalog of rich, transcendent experiences that might accumulate over a lifetime of religious devotion. Mm-hmm. But according to the findings, which were published in the peer-reviewed journal Psychedelic Medicine, the vast majority of the 33 clergy who participated in the study, more than 90%, said taking psilocybin was one of the most spiritually meaningful and deeply sacred experiences of their lives.
Huh.
Applause!
I mean, I wonder to what degree that's like, you get out of it what you bring to it, right?
Well, wait for it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, almost half said it was the most profound thing they'd ever experienced, period. It also said it made them better religious leaders.
Oh.
Now, some years later, some of these clergy have become evangelists for psychedelics, incorporating them into their own religious teachings. For some of them, the experience led to a release from attachment to dogmas and greater openness to other forms of religious experience.
Hmm.
For at least one participant, it was a dark, empty, terrifying trip. Still, none of them ruled out using psilocybin again in the future, even with that one who had the bad trip. And the reason it took apparently so long for the publication of the study was due to ethical lapses, including potential conflicts of interest related to funding sources, as well as the direct involvement of a funder in the research itself.
You mean capitalism ruined the party? Really?
I mean, it also kind of sounds like a guy was basically like, I want to get high. How can I get a grant to pay for that?
Exactly. Things I've said to myself many times.
Right, right.
But these conflicts were eventually resolved through disclosure, which the authors say they always intended. Questions also swirled around certain flaws in the study's execution, which even the authors, scientists at Johns Hopkins University in New York, admit. One issue was bias. So participants may have been primed to see their experiences sacred by language used in recruitment ads and by the experience of those running the experiment, and to your point, their lives. The sample was also small, heavily white, male, and mostly Christian. And representation of a number of major religions, including indigenous religious traditions, Hinduism, Taoism, Confucianism, were absent.
I mean, I'm not surprised that they couldn't get anyone Hindu, because I'm pretty sure there are actual tenets of the religion that are like, you cannot put things in your body. It would be like trying to get a Mormon who's like, I won't drink caffeine, but sure, I'll take LSD for you.
Right, but to your point, most religions today, Hinduism, Judaism, Buddhism, Christianity, all of them advocate not using mind-altering substances. Again, unless you hit those outliers.
Right,
it's because they come from a time where divorcing like bodily sensation in favor of the transcendental disembodied mind was a control technique. That all religions use. And I guess we're maybe stepping away from that.
Or stepping back in, you know, because many indigenous cultures in the Americas have been using mushrooms for ceremonies for a millennia. And there are many pagan mystical experiences in ancient Greece that may have served as foundations for some religion and even Christianity. So they're also thinking some of this tripping might have led to the religion itself.
Early on, yeah.
And then they mention here, but transcendence is not unequivocally good. As one religious scholar found, you can have too much of it. Or in the words of Benicio del Toro in Fear and Loathing, oh, you took too much, too much, too much.
Yeah. See, this is why, like, I have absolutely no problem with other people medicating and trying anything they want to try for themselves. I think I would definitely have a bad trip. I think I would bring horrible things to the table.
Maybe you need to have a bad trip.
Maybe. Maybe I'm like the one guy who's like, it was an awful trip. I'd do it again.
It was awful. I hit some things deep inside. I didn't want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you got it out. That's one way to process those feelings. Just saying.
Correct. Yeah. So everybody, next time you go to church, just make sure you eat a handful of mushrooms and
make the wafers out of them. Full on communion, man.
Exactly. All right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got one from Discover Magazine called Hungry Bacteria Hunt Their Neighbors with Tiny Poison-Tipped Harpoons.
Oh, what?
So the cool thing here is that they're not talking about, you know, this weird behavior that one obscure species does. This is something that a ton of different bacteria do. And in a sense, we've known about it. We just didn't understand until now what they were actually doing. Hmm. And it turns out it's pretty brutal. So many bacteria species have a defense mechanism called a type 6 secretion system, or T6SS. And it is essentially a tiny harpoon gun with a poison-tipped needle. And bacteria who have this weapon system are generally able to sense whether a neighboring cell is one of their own or a competing species. So when they bump up against a competitor, they stab out their little harpoon and inject a toxin through the neighboring cell wall, which somehow chemically encourages the enemy's internal fluids to rapidly flood outward through the hole and basically causes them to bleed out on the spot, which is fun. But it gets way better than that, because while we've known for a while that bacteria can kill each other in this way, scientists at Arizona State University recently noticed that the harpooning doesn't happen in the same way in every instance. When food is plentiful, for example, these bacteria go around stabbing each other like warriors fighting over territory. The deaths are quick and ragged, and the victor immediately moves on to another challenge. But when food is scarce, these bacteria turn into cold and calculating serial killers, because they're no longer just running their enemies through and spilling their guts all over the place. Instead, they actively choose to let their victims die slowly, leaking their nutrients and fluids out at a steady rate so that the attacking bacteria can consume them.
Ooh.
And again, we've known that certain bacteria can cannibalize each other in order to survive. The crazy thing here is that these species are very clearly in control of whether their victim bleeds out slowly or quickly. And we don't actually know for sure yet how they do it, but study author Glenda Souza is theorizing that they might be using different toxins in each case, depending on what they're trying to achieve. And of course, as always, scientists are hoping that this might have implications beyond, you know, the inherent drama of bacterial Game of Thrones, because if we could harness these toxins or modify the bacteria that use them, we could potentially develop new antibiotics that would be less susceptible to resistance.
Mm.
And, you know, maybe at some point we teach these little guys about the Geneva Convention, let them know that it's not cool to be draining the life force out of your enemies and watch them die slowly.
It's interesting, too, that that like little harpoon, if it's in bacteria, it seems like that harpoon mechanism is like old, like very old. So,
right. Very ancient.
Yeah. Like removing the sustenance from your enemy is a pretty classic art of war sort of technique.
Well, and they're very clear about like the bacteria that get stabbed with these harpoons, they don't die because of the stabbing. It's the draining. So there's like there's a long torturous aspect to this where like maybe we got to have like some bacterial Nuremberg trials to show that we need business. Like, I don't know. It felt way darker when I was reading it than it probably is, where it's just like, yeah, bacteria killed another bacteria. And it's not like people don't kill each other. I don't have a leg to stand on here. But
yeah, it's dark. That's dark.
Killing is necessary for life, I guess. Next link.
Next link.
Good news, everyone. According to Extreme Tech, ChatGPT lost a chess game to an Atari 2600. That's right.
That's so much better than losing to a person. It lost to an Atari. That's great.
It is. And on the beginner difficulty level, too. So computers and chess, not exactly new, since IBM's Deep Blue supercomputer defeated the then world chess champion and legendary player Garry Kasparov in 1997, chess engines have held a commanding lead over human counterparts. The latest Stockfish models have an estimated ELO, which is a chess rating, of over 3,600, while the best chess players in the world only ever crested 2,800. Now, ChatGPT and the Atari 2600 are both well below either of these rankings, but the matchup is intriguing. So, the engineer is a Citrix engineer named Robert Caruso, and he said that after chatting with ChatGPT about the history of chess, ChatGPT wanted to find out how quickly it would defeat a chess computer that can only think one or two moves ahead. and it requested to play against Atari's 1979 video chess cartridge.
Wow. So it was trying to, like, I'm going to pwn you.
And then it didn't ask to play against Deep Blue.
Yeah, it was very big ego bully behavior, how this was all brought about, which is a really useful lens in considering these large language models the way they exist right now. So Caruso pulled out an emulation of video chess and had ChatGPT analyze board positions based on images to decide its next moves. And he expected it to be a cakewalk for the cutting-edge large language model, which costs tens of millions of dollars in training alone.
Mm-hmm.
According to the engineer, quote, ChatGPT got absolutely wrecked on the beginner level. He goes on, despite being given a baseline board layout to identify pieces, ChatGPT confused rooks for bishops, missed pawn forks, and repeatedly lost track of where pieces were, first blaming the Atari icons as too abstract to recognize, then faring no better even after switching to standard chess notation. After an hour and a half, and even with Caruso helping ChatGPT from making some of its most catastrophically poor moves, it conceded, but not before asking if it could, quote, start over for another go. Now, it's fair to point out that ChatGPT is not a chess computer. But the way it's being described in all these lofty terms by creators at OpenAI and the AI evangelists who claim we're on the precipice of wider general AI development.
Well, if it makes ChatGPT feel any better, I doubt I could beat the Atari chess program either. So that's fine.
We'll let you keep your fragile ego, ChatGPT, for now.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from The Guardian. Y'all ready to be a little bit jealous?
Oh, no.
Uh-oh.
Canadian man wins lottery jackpots 4 times.
Whoa.
But is he just one of those guys who knows how to play the odds? Like, maybe it was a little bit. Maybe.
A little bit of both. So, okay. How do you say lottery winner in Western Canada? The answer is David Serkin. Okay. He's also a cancer survivor. So. Uh-huh. He's a lucky, lucky human being.
Yeah.
From Alberta, who won 3 separate lottery jackpots between August and May to accumulate $2.5 million in prize money.
Wait, he did this over under a year? At least for 3 of them?
Yeah, but those are also low dollar amounts, so it sounds like he's playing smaller games.
Low dollar, like in terms of...
Like he didn't win the Powerball.
Still, I mean, small, 3 winnings for 2.5. Yeah, that's small-ish.
Well, was it 2.5 total or 2.5
each? 2.5 total.
Yeah, so you divide that by 3, he's winning less than $1 million per game. So that's, yeah. I mean, as far as lotteries go, it's like...
Sounds like a job to me.
fair point. Yes, it's kind of like when I'm talking about music gear, and it's $10,000 for a microphone. I'm like, well, that's relatively cheap.
He's like, that's pretty cheap for a mic. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. According to officials... Those lucky tickets marked the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th times Serkin had won the lottery in his life, a feat that he had vanishingly small chances of pulling off and gained notice on corners of the internet dedicated to charming new stories like this one. So he says, I know the odds are astronomical, and I don't think it'll happen again, but I like buying tickets.
Okay.
Serkin won draws of $500,000 on August 20th, $1 million on the 16th, and $1 million on May 3rd. The last of those coming from a ticket that he bought at a gasoline station in his hometown of Lethbridge. So y'all know where to find him. To give an idea of the odds he faced, he had a 1 in about 33.3 million chance of winning the first of those jackpots. So add those up. I can't do that probability math. The media outlet Now Toronto added that Serkin had won another $250,000 lottery jackpot more than a decade before his newer streak of good fortune. At least part of his lottery success seems to involve consistently playing the odds. He told officials he's been playing the lottery since 1982. But he's maintained that it's because he simply enjoys the ritual of buying his tickets, not because he's addicted to gambling.
Of course not. Of course not. I give the money away. It's the buying that I like.
Yeah. It's the scratching.
Just give me anything that's got a scratch off and I could do it all day.
Right, so he's been buying them since 1982. Add that up. He's bought about $1.2 million in lottery tickets.
I'm
just kidding. I don't know how many he's actually bought. So he says, you check your ticket, and if you win, you're happy. If you don't, you can always try again. Says, okay. I'm a cancer survivor and I'm retired, so I'm just grateful for all of it. Yeah, you are, buddy. Mm-hmm. As Serkin said, he bought his latest triumphant ticket on a whim while buying gasoline, figuring, what have I got to lose? He said his friends reacted by saying, not again, when he took them out for coffee and informed them that he had hit the jackpot once more.
All right, buddy. You just dude, keep it you to yourself kidding. Now. Okay.
As Serkin put it, his wife was equally incredulous. And if history was any indication, a memorable vacation is in store for her.
Mm.
I took my wife to Hawaii with the last win. Now we're going to Newfoundland.
I feel like I want to know if this guy has kids, because if there's some genetic component to his luck, then like we need to start making sure that we spread that more in the gene pool. Or maybe not, because if everybody's lucky, then there's just no more lottery.
Yeah, I feel like he would have mentioned like his kids. So maybe he does and he just doesn't
take them to Hawaii.
Right. Or they're all successful enough that it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Right. And they absolutely hate that their dad does nothing but buy lottery tickets. They're like, I worked to become a doctor and this guy.
And he's not giving me any of it.
That's right.
Next link.
Next link.
All right, next up from IEEE Spectrum, we have a somewhat light but interesting overview on the next generation of rocket engines, specifically nuclear-powered rocket engines.
Whoa.
And I liked this article because various sci-fi shows that I watch frequently use, quote, fusion reactors as an explanation for why these characters can travel so much faster than we currently can. And I didn't really have a sense of how realistic or not that actually was. You know, there's always the Star Trek gobbledygook of just, we thrown some words together.
Yeah, some kind of anomaly.
There you go.
It's always an anomaly.
But it turns out in this case, yeah, they are possible. And we will probably be using them in the relatively near future. Because there's no question that nuclear rockets would be more efficient. With the traditional chemical explosion rockets we use today, there's a limit on how much power we can achieve. Because the fuel has to overcome the weight of the rocket, but the more fuel you add, the more weight you add. And nuclear fuel weighs so much less than chemical fuel, it's basically negligible.
Hmm.
Now, the article does take a moment to note that with the recent cuts to NASA's funding, there is no longer any allocation for nuclear propulsion research from American scientists. Fortunately, the European Space Agency does not have the same political problems we do, at least not currently. So they are the ones spearheading this new area of exploration. So thank you, Europe. And the first big question they have to answer is, of course, how do we make nuclear engines safe for the astronauts who are going to be sitting right next to those reactors? And it turns out, based on some recent modeling, that astronauts on nuclear-powered ships will actually be exposed to less radiation than they currently are.
Does it create like a magnetic field or something?
No. For one thing, the nuclear engines won't be running the entire time. They're so efficient that they'll only need a few short engine bursts lasting less than 2 hours each. And the uranium inside the rockets is only minimally radioactive when the engine is not operating. But what's more, astronauts are already exposed to a certain amount of cosmic radiation during space travel of any kind, and trips powered by nuclear fuel will be so much faster that they're going to come out ahead in their total exposure numbers.
Okay.
Because a crewed trip to Mars, for example, will get there nearly 5 months faster with a nuclear-powered rocket, which means five fewer months of cosmic radiation. So they're like, actually, guys, it's safer. And they acknowledge it is true that if things went wrong, a nuclear-powered rocket could hypothetically melt down and kill everyone.
I mean, but that's the same of a chemical rocket, too. It could explode.
Exactly.
And,
yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We know from personal historical experience that chemical rockets can explode and kill everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But so to minimize the potential fallout of that kind of scenario, the researchers say it's potentially feasible to design hybrid ships that still use chemical rockets to leave the Earth's atmosphere and only fire up the nuclear engines once they're safely away from the planet.
Okay.
And that, you know, doesn't do anything for the astronauts. They're definitely still going to die in that case, but at least it doesn't cause problems for the rest of the population. Like, you can see how controlled nuclear explosions on a regular basis out of Cape Canaveral and Houston and everywhere, it wouldn't be
high risk,
to say the
least.
Yes. Those nuclear rockets could also be jettisoned on the return trip, so we wouldn't have to worry about disposal after the fact either. And you might be saying to yourself, you know, I'm hearing a lot of would and could and potentially feasibles and all this, and you're not wrong. The ESA researchers who are coming up with these designs do note that there's a lot more research to be done, systems to be designed, testing facilities to be built, but ultimately they do seem pretty confident that it's going to be a question of when, not if. Which I guess means all the sci-fi writers are going to have to come up with something new.
Listen, sci-fi writers are always about coming up with something new. Give them some credit here.
Exactly. Our ship used an anomaly.
Yeah, we still have fission reactors, I guess.
There you go. And they do talk about there's actually two types of nuclear propulsion. There's thermal propulsion and electric propulsion. And they don't go into those at all. Like I said, it's a very light overview. Really, it feels like their main point was, look what Europe's doing, and we're not. It was a little snarky. Anyway. Next link.
Next link. All right. Science has finally done it. According to Science Alert, physicists have actually made the world's smallest violin.
Really?
It's true.
That's so endearing to me.
It is. Sorry. It is. Most of us are familiar with references to playing the world's smallest violin when someone is being overly whiny or wallowing in self-pity. But scientists have made the joke very literal by turning it into an actual microscopic object. And it's for a good reason. So physicists at Loughborough University in the UK deployed the latest in nanolithography techniques, etching patterns into materials at the smallest possible scales to create a violin drawing that's just 13 microns wide. That doesn't sound small enough. The human hair is about 180 microns in diameter.
What do you tune that violin to?
It does mention that you would probably need a tardigrade to just operate the dang thing because it's a drawing rather than an instrument. But the novel creation demonstrates ways in which the next generation of electronic devices could be made. Experimental physicist Kelly Morrison said, once we understand how materials behave, we can start applying that knowledge to develop new technologies, whether it's improving computing efficiency or finding new ways to harvest energy. But first, we need to understand the fundamental science, and this system enables us to do just that. So the violin was made through a four-step process. First, they took an incredibly fine heated needle to draw the violin pattern into a chip that was coated with polymer. Second, the part of the polymer that was written on was dissolved. The third stage was filling in that newly formed cavity in the polymer with platinum, fancy stuff. And the fourth and final step is removing the chip and the rest of the polymer, leaving behind the platinum violin. It's kind of like screen printing, if that sounded familiar to any craftsfolk out there, where you press ink through a stencil to create a picture on the underlying layer, but in this case, the scale is much, much smaller, and the equipment is much, much more sophisticated and expensive. The setup includes a sculpting machine. It's called a nanofrasor. Love that name. And it's enclosed in a glove box to keep out dust and other particles, which would be huge on the scale of what we're working on here. And anytime that improvements in miniaturization are made, they have implications for technologies, including computing. But for now, this is, so far, the world's smallest violin. Thought to have first been popularized by a mention in the TV series MASH back in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that's where it came from.
Yeah, there's a little linky link there if you want to kind of follow back. But yeah, pretty cool stuff.
I mean, I'm thinking about if you had a full-size violin made of platinum. What's the cost differential between that versus making the tiny one?
Probably the same.
Yeah.
The tiny one is expensive.
Yeah. Well, and the full size wouldn't be too heavy.
Well, who knows? Maybe we'll find like a hollow nanotube, whatever we need to actually match the level of true sadness and wallowing we're experiencing right now. That's the important part. Next link?
Next link.
Okay, this comes from New Atlas. Game changer, celiac test detects disease without triggering symptoms.
Oh, isn't that nice? Finally, in the year 2025.
Yeah, so those with celiac know it is frustratingly restrictive. And there's not really a good medical intervention other than just avoiding gluten altogether. Mm. What sucks, too, is that the diagnosis is arduous and usually involves consuming gluten to stimulate the autoimmune condition. But there may be a simpler, pain-free way of doing it thanks to a new blood test that can detect the biomarkers of celiac disease even when someone is on a gluten-free diet already.
Mm.
Scientists from the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, or WEHI, in collaboration with Australia's Novovia, they've developed a landmark blood test. They can identify gluten-specific immune cells or T cells even when they're not actively fighting inflammation. This new test can also identify asymptomatic celiac disease, which, again, current diagnostics miss.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big deal because silent celiac disease can still cause injury, which impacts how nutrients are absorbed and can lead to further long-term health issues.
Mm-hmm. It could also cause psychiatric symptoms. That's one
what?
Thing that... Yeah. No, I know a lot about this because I got family members. And there was a study in this mental institution in, I think, Denmark, where they basically, as an experiment, took all of their institutionalized schizophrenic patients and put them all on a gluten-free diet. And it was up to, I think, 1 in 4 had their symptoms greatly improved, if not fully resolved, and some of them were released.
That
and
makes
it was
sense,
like,
though. Yeah, that makes sense.
But it was one of those, like, we know that it can cause these symptoms, but it's so hard to get a psychiatrist to go, hey, you should look at gastrointestinal problems. It's just, there's not a lot of communication between fields.
No. Right. No. And nutrition information and education for Western medicine has always been kind of lagging, right?
Mm-hmm.
So building on the findings from 2019... they identified overactivity of the immune marker interleukin-2, or IL-2, as a celiac disease fingerprint. Hmm. The team took blood samples from 181 participants, 75 people managing their disease with gluten-free diets, 13 with an active and untreated condition, and 32 with non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and 61 healthy recruits. Hmm. Their bloods were combined with gluten for a day and then tested to identify the IL-2 marker. And the results were reliable, 90% sensitivity and 97% specificity.
So they actually put gluten in the blood. They're still stimulating the response. They're just saying we don't have to do it inside your body.
Right. Mm-hmm. It looks that way. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
And essentially, this means that blood screening is accurate with a very low rate of false positives.
Mm-hmm.
Still get some, right? 90% and 97, but that's still better than where we were at.
Nothing. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And they found that people with more extreme celiac symptoms had the most IL-2 activity, which gives both patient and medical professionals a clear information about the situation.
Oh.
So good news for celiac folks.
Yeah.
I mean, if that could be a thing to say.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Man Who Unsolved a Murder, How Steelworkers Stopped a Paramilitary Movement, and The Science Behind the Smell of Rain. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on damninteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/damninterestingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.